thanks for joining us today. This is Town Call, a brand new approach to homegrown radio where you are the star, you are the talent, and you will drive the talking points of the day. If you'd like to participate in today's forum, give us a call or shoot us a text, 844-967-2789. I'm William Walter, Policy Research Director and Lead Training Organizer with our Wisconsin Revolution. We got Luke Mathers in studio today as well. Luke, how are you doing on this Thursday afternoon?
I'm doing well, Will. I would have done better had volleyball gone better last night, but you know, it's one of those things where you chalk up the wins that you can. So it was more of an evening of moral victories on the volleyball court more than actual victories. But glad to be with you here on the Thursday across the airwaves of Civic Media.
And I got softball tonight, so that whole Wednesday night game is a little odd. I'm so used to ending my week on a good note.
See, last year I did volleyball on Wednesdays, softball on Thursdays, and Friday at work, I was just dead. So I cut out the Thursday softball this summer, but I am missing it, man. I'm missing getting the chance to get out on a field and play a little softball.
You'll have to swing by Germantown sometime. I'll hook you up with my squad. We'll get you out there again.
The ringer. Maybe not. Bringing in the ringer.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying we need you. We don't need you. But you're welcome to join us if you would like to come have some fun on a Thursday night. We got Aaron on the ones and twos. Aaron, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing well. Did not sleep much last night, but I'm awake now thanks to some caffeine.
And that's all that really matters, right? We got you here now when it matters. And we also have my good friend, Professor John Shelton. Class is in session. Office hours are going on today. Professor Shelton, how are you doing this afternoon?
Hey, William. Hey, Luke. How's it going? You know, you're talking about playing sports. I play a weekly pickup basketball game, and I got to tell you, I think I'm a little older than y'all. For me, the only victory I'm looking for is like not straining a muscle. So those are my moral victories. You'll get there. You'll get there.
Your victory is the coming couple of days, right? As long as you're able to get out of bed still, that's a win.
Uh-huh. If both of my hamstrings are intact, I'm happy.
That's the minimum you want to leave with once you get off the court. That makes sense. Well, we appreciate you joining us for office hours here across Civic Media. If you've got a question for Professor Shelton, give us a call. Send us a text, 844-967-2789. You're listening to Town Call across Civic Media. And Will, let's get to the subject of what we want to discuss with the professor while we have him here on this Thursday afternoon.
Well, Professor, the big story of the past couple days and that the issue that I think is most prevalent that I want to talk about is the Teamsters winning a historic contract with UPS. We've changed the game, Teamsters press release announces. You are not only a historian, but you have a significant background working with organized labor. And I want to hear from an expert like yourself on why this is so important, why it matters for the rest of us, and what regular Americans can learn from these working class heroes.
Yeah, so first of all, let me say, you know, I'm president of my union, the faculty and staff union at UW-Green Bay. And then I also serve as a VP for higher ed for the state fed for AFT, Wisconsin American Federation of Teachers. The reason I am a union member is probably because my uncle, Steve Shelton, who was a Teamster, talk to me about unions. It's why I understood the importance of the labor movement from an early age. So the Teamsters are a union that are near and dear to my heart. And you know, you think about what that union did, going back all the way into the 40s and 50s. You know, they effectively, through collective action, allowed working class people to have economic security, good lives. I mean, my uncle has a pension right now because of the Teamsters and because of the work he did and his coworkers in union organizing. So that's the legacy that we're dealing with. And I think it's important to note that, you know, the Teamsters are obviously a really important union now, but they also have this longer historical legacy that we have to pay attention to. This is a huge win. You know, I think one of the things that's so important about it is that the sheer number of Teamsters who work for UPS, and the scale the scale of this industry, right? I mean, that you know, so many things across this country move around, like literal the economic activity of this country is built on shipping things, and UPS is essential to that. And these workers leverage their power. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of workers who said, you know, we are essential to the functioning of this economy, and we're going to use that. We're going to organize, and we are not going to accept a contract that continues to not allow us to have dignity at work, right? And you think about some of the things that these workers were fighting for in this strike, having air conditioning in trucks. I mean, everybody who's out there right now in Wisconsin, right? We've got this heat wave. It's in the 90s up here in Green Bay, which almost never happens. We have a deep appreciation for how hot it is right now. Imagine having to work in those conditions across the country day in and day out when you're having to move very quickly and deliver X amount of packages every hour. That's basic dignity at work to have air conditioning in those trucks. And that was a sort of basic thing that these folks were striking for. But to me, what's also amazing about it, right, big wage increases for just about every category of worker, which are well-deserved. But this is a trend among a number of unions lately to not just think about the highest paid worker, but to think about everybody who's working. And so one of the big sticking points in this contract was wage increases, significant wage increases for part-time workers, eliminating a two-tiered system that had existed before for different kinds of full-time workers, and giving part-time workers a path to becoming full-time and to very rapidly getting wage increases. That's really important because what that shows, first of all, that builds solidarity, but it also shows that, you know, workers who's making $45 an hour getting a better deal, it's about everybody getting a good deal. And that's actually what's good for all workers. And believe it or not, what's good for UPS. It's in their interest actually to have a workforce that's stable and where people don't feel like they want to leave all the time, especially right now when there's, you know, many businesses are struggling to bring in workers. So you really can't overstate this. And these workers won because they were militant, because they refused to accept a subpar deal. And that's what we need in this country, you know, to build the kind of world that every single American who works for a living has the economic security that they deserve.
And something we've talked about in the past, Professor, is, and you just noted, workers are the engine of the American economy. Our labor is what makes everything work. We have a right to demand a just and fair contract for every single one of our employees. And something I think that's interesting as well is you noted the raw numbers. There's 340,000 UPS Teamsters nationwide. This is one of the largest unions in the United States. I believe, at least according to Wikipedia, Teamsters is the fourth largest labor union in the entire country with about 1.4 million members. The UPS Teamsters was about 340,000, so still absolutely, absolutely massive. The lucrative contract raises wages for all workers, according to Teamsters, creates more full-time jobs and includes dozens of workplace protections and improvements. Something like air conditioning. That's so basic, so simple to keep your employees safe. You can't have, employees can't continue to work at a high level if they're forced into dangerous situations. And a lot of, like, I have friends and contacts who have noted to me when I've been discussing the UPS strike, they'll be saying, and this is people across the political spectrum, conservative, liberal, everything. They'll be noting, yeah, my UPS driver came in today and he was just dripping sweat. It was only 2 p.m. He still had hours and hours left on his shift, but he has to sprint in, deliver the package, sprint out and get back going because you're on a tight time frame. It's frankly barbaric to not provide something as minimum as climate controlled vehicles for these employees who are working their butts off for you, for a company that had billions and billions in dollars in profit. And you touched on how important it is. I think this is historic. I'm really happy to be able to have you on today to discuss why this is so important.
Yeah, you know, and you look at some of the big labor, you know, big labor conflicts that have happened over the past year. You know, oftentimes when people think about unions, they think about, you know, workers fighting for higher wages or higher salaries. And certainly that was the case with these UPS strikers or potential strikers. But, you know, one of the things that you look at some of the other examples, many of these strikes are about workplace safety and dignity, right? If you look at the Amazon organizing drive, right? These are workers who are, you know, oftentimes aren't allowed to, don't have time to take bathroom breaks because their movements are surveilled so much, you know, or don't get paid for the time that they literally have to, you know, go through security to make sure they're not stealing things from this billion, multi-billion dollar company, right? This company that's headed by a guy who has so much money, you know, he decided to go into space, Jeff Bezos, right, or whatever, you know? And you think about the rail strikers from last December who, you know, unfortunately, I think the Biden administration made a huge mistake in not allowing them to go on strike, because you can see the kind of economic might these workers have when they organize and show the power that they have. I think those workers could have got a much better deal than they did. But that strike was really about people having days off to go to the doctor.
5 or 6 days off. That's all, like a minimal paid leave request.
So we have these companies. I mean, you nailed it, William. These companies that are raking in billions of dollars in profits, who have these CEOs, you know, who are getting hundreds of millions of dollars a year in compensation. And it's not enough that they underpay their workers. They want to also treat them like they're not people, right? To not recognize their basic human dignity. And to me, that's what so much what these strikes are about, are these workers saying, no, we're people. We have families. We deserve to have a time off to go to the doctor. You know, we deserve to not be drenched in sweat and potentially dealing with heat exhaustion because we're being pushed to the breaking.
People are dying.
Exactly.
People are literally dying across the country because of that.
Exactly. And then you look at teachers, right? I mean, teachers, the two biggest unions in the country are the NEA and the AFT, my union, of course. And, you know, many of the teachers that you've seen walking out in the past, you know, decade, they're fighting for better conditions for their students. In many cases, yeah, they're looking for salary increases, but they want to make sure their students have access to things like housing and you know, immigration protection, right, in places like Chicago and LA. So that's what these fights are about. They're about changing the entire political structure in this country so that, you know, the powers that be recognize that workers have basic human dignity, right? That somebody should give a damn about these people.
Folks, you're listening to Town Call. I'm Luke Mathers. He's William Walter. We're joined on a Thursday afternoon by Professor John Shelton for a little office hours with the professor. If you'd like to join the conversation, have a question for the professor, 844-967-2789. You can take us with you on the go wherever you go. If you're listening on the dial, go check out the Civic Media app as well. You can download us, put us in your pocket, and you can do that on the Apple or Google Play stores. You can call and text right from the app. It's a tremendous app. If you haven't already downloaded it yet, please do so. We're going to continue the conversation with Professor Shelton and take your phone calls, 844-967-2789. Town Call is going to be right back.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest.
Welcome one, welcome all, welcome back. This is Town Call, a brand new approach to homegrown radio. If you'd like to participate in today's forum, give us a call or shoot us a text, 844-967-2789. We got office hours in today. The professor is here. We are talking the power of labor in the United States, specifically relating to the Teamsters' historic contract with UPS. And Professor Shelton, something that you and I were discussing a little bit during the break that I think needs to be expanded on is how often media outlets paint the striking workers as the bad guys. They throw numbers out there noting how impactful these strikes will be. For example, you know, a 10-day strike would cost the economy more than $7 billion and be the costliest work stoppage in at least a century, according to a new study by Anderson Economic Group. This includes $4.6 billion in losses to consumers and businesses that rely on UPS, as well as more than $1 billion in lost wages and $800 million in company losses. A lot of this is done specifically to say, you know, look, regular Americans, these people are hurting your lives. They're going to be costing the economy billions of dollars. They're going to be preventing you from getting access to the things you need to run your business, when the reality of the situation is that's proving the striking workers' point. It is proving that these people are invaluable assets to our community, that they are the ones generating value, that they are the ones deserving not just of respect, but of being treated fairly economically for the value and that they create. And it's kind of gross, in my opinion, to see how often words and language is used to instead paint the opposite picture. I mean, it's propaganda. It's tricking the readers into believing this false reality. Could you please expunge on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, let's talk about it. The first thing I would say is, you know, I'm gonna take the most charitable interpretation I can toward journalists that do that, right? Because you're right. Like, I've seen a number of those stories. Actually, I was just looking at a story in terms of the SAG-AFTRA strike, you know, the Actors Guild, and the so-called effects to the economy, the, you know, billions of dollars or whatever that are going to be impacted. Let's be charitable though, and point out that it's maybe not even that these journalists are intentionally doing that. It's that, you know, we increasingly don't treat labor like journalists don't understand labor, a lot of them, right? I mean, a lot of them do. Some of them are union members, actually, in many cases. But, you know, it was very common when, you know, like 35% of Americans were in unions and covered by collectively bargained contracts in like the 1950s and 60s, for newspapers to have labor beats, where you would have journalists that's all they did was cover, you know, collective negotiations and unions. And so they understood many of those dynamics more than probably a lot of contemporary reporters do now. So let's maybe be charitable and just, I do this in my classrooms, right? Like, let's assume that this is coming from a place of people not knowing and try to enlighten them.
Ignorance rather than malice.
Yes. But your bigger point is absolutely correct, right? I mean, what does that show when there's this big of an impact on the economy? It shows how absolutely essential these workers are to all of the things that happen every day. But even more than importantly than that, let's think about what the impact of this is for the impact of a successful strike, a winning strike is for workers, right? The vast majority of Americans work for a living. We sell our labor every day to make ends meet, whether that's through wages on the hour or through our salaries. And so when a union is successful in getting a better deal, that's actually good for all of us, even people who are not in unions. What do you think FedEx is, which is, you know, and some of these other kinds of companies that do similar work, what do you think they're going to have to do to retain workers now that UPS is paying its workers more? They're going to have to up their wages potentially and improve their working conditions, or workers are going to be able to go to a competing company. So anybody else who works in that sector is going to be positively impacted. You know, not to mention that just even more broadly, having more workers and unions getting better contracts is better for all workers, right? Because that sets a better example and makes other employers have to be more competitive, even outside of that sector, right? Because
I love cliches, Professor, and it's a rising tide lifts all boats, right? Like, phrases and sayings like these exist for a reason.
I was thinking it. I wasn't going to say it because that was coined by Kennedy when he was talking about his tax cuts for the rich in the 1960s. So I wasn't going to go there.
Oh, I dropped the ball. That's the historian in you knowing more than me.
Right. But that's but sure. And so, you know, a momentary decrease in economic production, that's the only leverage that workers have, right? Employers have so much leverage. They own all of the machinery. They own all of the productive capacity. They can fire people at will. They are able to, you know, take more time. They're able to have losses in a way that workers maybe can't incur personal losses. And so the only leverage that workers have is to collectively withhold their labor. And if that's costing the economy a lot of money, you're right. That just proves how much power they actually have, and they need to use it. And the third point that I want to make, and this is really important, is why are we blaming workers for the loss of economic capacity, right? As the UPS strike clearly shows, when the company provides a fair contract for workers, these workers weren't greedy, right? They just wanted a fair contract with air conditioning and a path to a full-time work for people who wanted it and enough money to make ends meet. When companies do that, right, workers don't go on strike, the economy is not going to lose money because of this, because the employer treated them fairly. It's the employers that aren't interested in having a fair contract. They're the ones at fault. they're the ones who are actually costing the economy money. They're the ones who those small businesses are actually hurt by.
One of the aspects that I'd like to get into, Professor, is do you believe the timing of when these contract negotiations made the difference? Do you think the fact that the rail workers were threatening to go on strike during the holiday season when a lot of the commerce, I think more people are focused on buying things, the purchasing of goods in the month of December, probably more likely than the month of July. Do you think that timing came down to the fact that these Teamsters were not kneecapped? They did not have the collective power taken away from them by Congress and the Biden administration intervening and saying, no, you can't strike. Do you believe that that played a role in why this negotiation came to an end and an agreement tentatively here that's going to be voted on? Or what are your thoughts on how the time of year that the contract negotiations took place during affected the outcome for these two different cases?
That's a great question. The short answer to that is it affected it a little bit, but it wasn't the most important factor, right? And I'll explain what I mean by that. The difference between these two groups of workers is that rail workers are covered by separate legislation, right? It's legislation that actually goes back to the early 20th century. That gives Congress and the president much more power to intervene directly in labor negotiations. So it would not have been possible for the Biden administration and Congress to step in and force the UPS workers to go back to work. It's technically possible. It would have been much harder. I don't want to get into all of the legal stuff, but under Taft-Hartley in 1947, this law that significantly restricted some labor rights, it would have been possible ultimately at some point for the Biden administration to get an injunction to stop the strike, but it's much more difficult than it would have been, for the rail workers, where Congress has had the direct capacity to intervene. The problem is, this is where the timing I think was important, is the Biden administration saw that and said, well, we have to intervene here because this will impact Christmas. I think they made a huge mistake. Okay. I think the Biden administration made a major, major mistake. And right now, when you hear, folks talking about how Biden is this, very union friendly president, that's true in some ways. But I think he made a grave mistake, the rail workers to strike in December, because, I think the rail workers would have won that strike because they had so much economic capacity. And again, that would have been a powerful signal to all the other workers out there that the administration was going to have their back and was going to stand on their side when it came to having basic dignity at work.
It's about the message, right? You're sending the message that the powers that be have your back.
In labor, right, there's y'all probably know the song. It goes back to the 1930s in some of the Kentucky coal wars song that was written by a coal miner's wife in West Virginia, Kentucky. Florence Reese, which side are you on, right? And there's no middle ground in these labor conflicts, right? I mean, you either support the workers or you support the millionaires and billionaires.
100%. So we're going to go to the phone lines now. If you have any questions for Professor Shelton, office hours are on and the professor is in. Give us a call, 844-967-2789. We're going to Andrea in Menominee Falls first. Andrea, what is your question for Professor Shelton?
Hi. So my question involves unions, obviously, and I guess to preface it, I work in a field where there's a lot of monopolization going on, so I'm pretty fearful for the rights of the workers around me. So what would you suggest to use as a handbook for starting a union?
So first of all, thanks for the call, Andrea. It sounds like you're driving. So if you're driving, drive safely. There's a lot of things out there. Some of the most recent stuff that I think is most interesting is the work of, what is her name? I'm completely drawing a blank. Oh, it's one of those days. Heat's getting Jane McAlevey, who is writing about union stuff, but from the perspective of kind of deep organizing, And she's got book I would start with, actually, she's got a more recent book, but the book I would start with is a book called No Shortcuts, which looks at the best way to build kind of rank and file member driven organizing at your workplace. So that's where I would start, honestly, in terms of thinking about power and really how workers can build it. Because a lot of times, you know, we think about the kind of institutional apparatus of unions, and that's really important. But what a union really is at base is a group of workers who are all advocating collectively for something, right? And so we can get kind of bogged down sometimes in, you know, who's the president and how do these negotiations work and this kind of top-down driven model. But what a union really is, it has to be as strong as it's workers who are all involved in organizing and working together. And I think McAlevey's work is some of the best stuff recently helping us to really kind of think that through. So I'd start there.
Tremendous. We appreciate the phone call, Andrea, from Menominee Falls. If you want to be like Andrea, 844-967-2789. You can call in to Town Call. We are joined by Professor John Shelton on this Thursday afternoon discussing the rise in unions or the growing nature of strikes that are being referred to. We had John Deere on strike recently. Frito-Lay was on strike. The Screen Actors Guild, as you've already noted, striking. The Teamsters not having to strike at UPS with that historic deal being reached for UPS. If you've got a question for the professor, we want to hear it. 844-967-2789. Up next on this Thursday afternoon, we got Ralph in Milwaukee calling in. Ralph, what's your question for the professor?
Well, it's more a statement than a question. I happen to be retired from an occupation that's very similar to the Teamsters jobs for UPS, and that's a retired city letter carrier. And currently our contract with the post office is up, and this week the 60-day period from when the contract ended to when we can continue to negotiate before binding arbitration occurs. And so for my union, we don't have the right to strike. And so in that case, we're out there slaving away in the hot sun and the cold winters and all the things that the UPS driver does. And when it comes to negotiating our contract, we're often compared to similar occupations, and UPS is one. And then, of course, the other parcel delivery services that exist are out there too, but those are usually non-union. And so my point that I'm trying to make here is that for some occupations, there's a union, but we don't have the right to strike. And even with arbitration or non-arbitration, if we're lucky to get 2% raises a year for maybe a 3-year contract, that's 6% for the whole year or for the whole contract length, whereas UPS is getting a doggone good, I should say the Teamsters are getting a doggone good agreement with their employers. So they deserve it. And I got to admit that I'd like to see something like that be able to be.
Sorry to cut you short,
Ralph. Thanks for the call, Ralph.
We're heading into a break. This is Town Call. If you want to join the conversation, 844-967-2789. You're listening to Cross Civic Media. We'll be right back. This land is
yours. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
My daddy was a miner.
Welcome, one. Welcome, all. Welcome back. This is Town Call, a brand new approach to homegrown radio. If you'd like to participate in today's forum, give us a call. Shoot us a text, 844-967-2789. It is office hours, and the professor is in. Now, Professor, I want to touch on something that Ralph noted before the break. I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that because I think you had a really good answer and something that's really needs to be heard.
Yeah. So first of all, thanks for the call, Ralph, and thanks for your work delivering for the U.S. Postal Service all those years. Like, that's absolutely essential work. There is a really interesting history with the Postal Service. And if anybody wants to learn more about this, there's a couple of great books written by this historian named Philip Rubio about the Postal Service and its history. Postal workers used to be direct employees of the federal government. In the 19th century, Postal Service was the main service that the federal government provided. And postal workers in the late 1960s, they were covered by a number of different unions. They all went on strike in 1970. And the strike was illegal because federal employees weren't allowed to go on strike. But because those workers were so essential in the economy, the Nixon administration couldn't really do anything other than negotiate. They got significant salary increases and a number of other worker protections coming out of that strike. But kind of the trade-off was that then Congress came in and partially, there's a very complex history, but partially it was to kind of like rein in the militants of these workers, many of whom were African-American like civil rights activists in places like New York and Chicago and other places. But they passed a law that made the Postal Service essentially a quasi-public corporation. And then a few years after that, I'm trying to think of exactly when that happened. Ralph might know, but I think it was the late 70s or early 80s. They implemented binding arbitration, which when a contract comes up for these postal workers now, there's an arbitration process that is literally binding for both the government and the workers. So it prevents, you know, the employer from doing something really bad, like, you know, concession bargaining, taking away benefits or something like that. It makes it much more difficult to do that. But it also takes away their primary piece of leverage, which is to walk out and go on strike. And so he's right. That does make it more difficult in some ways for postal employees, you know, to get the kind of contract that UPS workers are able to get. And, you know, theoretically, those workers, even though it would be illegal, they could still go on strike, right? I mean, like, you know, all they would have to do is if they won the strike, they could effectively, you know, make one of the concessions that like nobody gets punished as a consequence. But it's much harder to do that, particularly after, you know, the stance that Ronald Reagan took in the early 80s with the professional air traffic controllers, when Reagan actually fired like 10,000 air traffic controllers and replaced them with you know, non-union workers.
Ralph, are you aware of when that forced arbitration came into play for contracts like yours?
It was around 1979 or 80, 81, somewhere near. The professor's right about a timeline there.
Good. I'm glad my memory hasn't escaped me on that.
We appreciate the phone call, Ralph. We appreciate your contribution and sharing that information with us. If you want to be like Ralph, 844-967-2789, you can call or text here on Town Call. Even better, if you're on the Civic Media app, you can do it all right from there. But we're talking labor. The other strike that we've mentioned a couple times now is the Screen Actors Guild striking in Hollywood. It's probably one of the more well-known strikes right now. The fact that Hollywood is shut down, the writer's strike began earlier this summer, the screen actors now joining them in strike. What can you share with us, just your thoughts on what's going on? Because for a lot of this, I believe it is perspective of how the narrative gets told by media, how we talk about things like this is perspective. And for some of the coverage of the Screen Actors Guild strike that I've seen, it's like, well, these Hollywood elites that they don't want to work. How much money do they want to earn? And it gets back to, as you pointed out a number of times on today's show, the collective need for fairness in the industry. What can you tell us a little bit more about this Screen Actors Guild strike in Hollywood?
Yeah, again, this is a strike that's about dignity, just like the Writers Guild, right, who are also on strike. There's only been one other time, I think, in the 20th, since, you know, the advent of Hollywood, when both unions have been on strike at the same time.
And who was the president at that time of the union, John?
Oh, that was our only president who's ever been the president of a union, Ronald Reagan, who was the president.
Patron saint of destroying unions, Ronald Reagan. Yes.
Exactly. Who led a very successful Screen Actors Guild strike. And what was that, 1960, I think? This is a strike both of these strikes are about dignity, right? And, you know, with streaming services kind of changing the dynamic, and now artificial intelligence, right? I mean, we're closer than you think to that really seriously disrupting these industries. I don't know if anybody watches Black Mirror, but the first episode of the new season of Black Mirror really gets into this in some interesting ways. Check it out. It gets into, you know, a whole apparatus where artificial intelligence can rapidly produce, you know, TV shows. So, you know, this is what these workers are thinking about. They're concerned with their long-term economic security. As Fran Drescher, who's the president, remember her from The Nanny, very, very pro-labor. There's actually some interesting, at least one interesting pro-labor episode of The Nanny that I highly recommend people check out. Fran Drescher has spoken about this very eloquently. The vast majority of the, like, what is it, like 150 or 200,000 members of SAG-AFTRA are actually making less than like $25,000 a year. These are people who are trying to break into acting, and many of them have second jobs. And so, you know, this is about largely, it's not the wealthy, you know, it's not Tom Hanks trying to, you know, make more money here. This is actually, and think about how this connects to the Teamster strike, right? Fighting for those part-time workers. This is about the lower paid workers getting a fair deal and having a sustainable future, one where they're treated with dignity, one where they have healthcare, you know, and are able to make ends meet on a kind of permanent basis. That's what this strike is about. When again, you have millionaire and billionaire CEOs, what does the CEO of Disney make every year in compensation? Like $250 million.
It was like 75 grand a day.
Yeah.
For Bob right? Iger.
So that's what this is about. And it's no different. Even though these folks are working in Hollywood, this is no different than the Teamsters. This is no different than the rail workers. This is no different than those Starbucks workers and Amazon workers trying to get a contract. This is, folks, this is the fight for our future right now. It's happening. Workers are across this country are standing up and saying no more, that the American promise, what the American promise is about, is dignity and long-term economic security. And that's what all these workers are fighting for right now. Pay attention to this, because this is the fight for our future. And right now, the workers are winning.
And like you noted, John, this impacts all of us. Even if your industry is not directly involved, as a working class, we will all benefit from these type of actions. So thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Shelton. This was Office Hours. We'll have you back in 2 weeks. You'll have to be ready if you have any questions or concerns. We will have another opportunity to speak with the professor. Give us a call, 844-967-2789, if you want to contribute a Wisconsin headline for tomorrow. We'll see you then.
Talk to y'all later.
Which side are you on?